Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. Today's show is a double-double, so to speak. Two segments, but two segments that each feature two people. We have James Blockland and Andrea Moody, who are the writers and directors of the new film, 52 Words for Love. And you'll also hear from dancers and choreographers, Juri Hirauka and Tyler Gledhill, who are with Opera Atelier and are with a new show with that company that premieres. It's called The Angel Speaks, and it's one night only on February 21st at the Royal Ontario Museum. But first, this is my conversation with Andrea Moody and James Blockland about their film, 52 Words for Love, which blends a narrative fiction with documentary about love. So here's my conversation with James and Andrea. Andrea Moody, James Blockland. Hello. Good afternoon. How's it going today?
Hey.
Good. Thanks for having us.
Survive. Well, thanks for having me. I guess I'm a guest in your area. Surviving this sort of weird weather we've been having lately. This the up and down.
Yeah, I'm waiting for the spring. Counting the weeks.
It's funny because during the time we were shooting the film, we were always looking for like when it was snowing. And like, let's get everybody together. Let's get this is gonna snow tomorrow. Like, they're gonna have to shoot tomorrow. We'd like, be chasing the snow some of those winter sequences.
Even we wouldn't have been out in this weather.
No. Although there was that one shoot that was in a blizzard with you and Alan in the market with Suzanne.
Oh, yeah.
It was like pretty crazy blizzard.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway.
You know, that's funny. How much does, especially, you know, on a film like this, it often has tighter schedules and set everything. How much does weather affect what you can and can't do?
I think for us, because we were trying to capture the feeling going through a whole year, it wasn't so much that we were weather dependent, it was that we were weather grabbing. So we were wanting to get snow, we were wanting to get rain, we were wanting to get beautiful spring days, we were wanting to get cherry blossoms. We were wanting to feel and leaves falling and just feel the different seasons. So I don't think we ever canceled anything for weather, did we?
No. As a matter of fact, there was one shoot that comes to mind where we were shooting in Trinity Bellwoods Park, and we had a couple of scenes that we were going to shoot, and we were literally just about set up and ready to go. As a matter of fact, we started rolling the camera, and about 5 seconds into it, it just started to pour. And we thought, okay, well, we'll just wait it out, see what happens. But it not only did it pour, it just was like the most torrential deluge you could imagine. And then, so we ended up shooting anyway, but we shot a completely different beat that involved the rain. So we got the actor to kind of walk through the park in the rain, and it ended up being kind of a signature shot for us. Mm-hmm. And it was the kind of shot that, you know, you would have had to spend, like, to do that for a real movie, it would have cost you, you know, $10,000 to have the rain, you know, trees going and the lighting and everything. And it just happened, and we were able to capitalize on it, which was, you know, it was great. So we try to work with what was happening and make that work for us as opposed to fighting it all the time.
Yeah.
So the film is 52 Words for Love. I really enjoy the concept. You two both wrote it and directed it together. Multiple writers on a film is not uncommon. Multiple directors is a little more rare. How do you approach working together in that capacity, the directing, trying to both do the same job?
If we both like it, it stays.
Yeah, and if one of us has an issue, we try to take on the issue as if it were our own, like each other's concerns. Because most of the times we found it was better to have a second set of eyes, you know, and somebody that has your back. If you feel that your partner will take your concerns seriously, then, you know, you feel more comfortable to actually try stuff and experiment and go a little further, because you know that, you know, you've got a different perspective to rely on. Mm-hmm. It took a little while, I think, at first to get into the swing of that.
And we've been working together for a long time before we started making this film. Like, we go back to when I met Jim right after I finished theater school. So I went to film school and then went to theater school, and Jim was one of the first people I met when I moved to Toronto. So we would go back that far. But it's still, I think once we started to get our groove, it's sort of like Jim's doing one thing while I'm doing another, and we're sort of tag teaming, and there starts to be a flow to it where I sort of look over and I'm like, yeah, Jim's doing that, so I'll do this, and you sort of pick up on what each other's focus is that day. And who has more energy sometimes? Like,
yeah.
One of us comes to set and I'm like, wow, I'm just on fire today. And I was like, oh, thank God, because I really need a coffee, right? So there's that too. There's like an ebb and flow to who's having a food low and who's feeling energized.
Yeah. We also learned pretty early on that it was important not to try to judge it too much when you're in the moment, you know? Because there were some times we were shooting something and I'd be looking over at Andrew thinking like, oh my God, like this is just not working or it's not happening. And there were other times, you know, where I thought, oh yeah, this is really great. It's really working well. And I found out over time that when you look at it afterwards, that's when you really can assess what you got or didn't get. And when you're in the moment, you really have to just kind of let it happen and be willing to make a mistake, be willing to let something go horribly wrong and see. And you also don't know for sure until the final edit. Sometimes having those options, you know, you can figure out ways to make a beat work because you're trying now to make it work in a different way than what you knew on the day when you were shooting. So
yeah. And also there's those moments where you're on set and it just feels like everything's gelling and the scene is so awesome. Then you get back in the suite and you go, oh, it's not really on camera the way I felt in the room. And sometimes it feels like the day is really off. And you think, oh, I don't know, we got much, but we tried for options, we played, we come back, and then you start to cut it together. You go, oh, hey, that's really working a lot better than I imagined it would.
Yeah, the key really became, I think, trying to be playful, you know, and stay in the moment and work with what is and let it happen, let it evolve, and try to create space for the actors.
Mm-hmm. And because we work with such a small crew, really pared down crew, like we're usually like three or four crew people in our DP, Alan, so we had a lot of ability to adjust to what was happening, move the camera because that felt right, or let the actors have a kick at the can that was totally improvised. And a lot of it was like that, or just experiment a bit more than you would normally have the chance to do on a bigger production with a bigger crew, where things are sort of already set in stone before you get the actors on set. So we could adjust to what was happening organically a bit more, which was great.
In terms of writing, you know, because whenever I talk to bands, like one person takes care of the lyrics, we all do the music or this and that. Being a writing team, do you guys find that you do maybe, Jim, you'll do one scene, Andrew, you'll do another scene and then talk about it, or do you always write everything together?
That's a really good question. Because there's so much back and forth between shooting and writing and shooting
and editing, right?
Exactly. What I was going to say is that a lot of the writing actually happened in the edit suite. So we would get material back and we'd say, okay, let's keep these bits, let's lose these bits. And so that, so it's sort of an ebb and flow of like, I might go away and write the next three scenes that we were going to shoot and send them to Jim, and then he'd send me notes, and Jim might be cutting a bunch of things and sending me, and then we'd talk and then we'd sit in the suite together. So it's like a really sort of a real ebb and flow back and forth in terms of the story and how we worked back and forth on it.
Yeah. And with Andrea's background, more on the writing side, or at least a large portion on the writing side. Mm-hmm. And my background was more on the editorial side. Often you were Andrea was the person who would kind of first take the first kick at it after we would talk about what the scene was going to be, etc. And I'm probably a better rewriter, and as an editor, that's often what you do, although nowadays I do a lot of documentary work as well. So as an editor, you do essentially a lot of writing as well, mm-hmm. in the room, because you don't have a script when you do a documentary in the same way that you do with a drama.
Yeah.
But we were mixing both worlds, regularly borrowing from each, as the film does too, so.
It mentions that you sort of it does have a narrative script, but there's also a lot of documentary stuff happening. Mm-hmm. In terms of finding the right especially when you're mixing styles, in terms of finding the right tone that you want for the movie, and I guess the right arc when it's not completely a linear storyline. How much of that for you came out in post, in the editing, and how much of that did you find was already present while you were shooting?
We had both, actually. Mm-hmm. We had general storylines and arcs for all the character through lines, I'd say pretty much without exception.
Yeah.
And then we also architected those in post, and often ended up modifying them or changing the trajectories or whatever, depending on the flow.
Mm-hmm. I think we started with a really old outline that I had. We had the same title, and was an ensemble piece. And because we really wanted to work with a diverse cast and work loosely, so we weren't too tied to any one actor, because it was going to take a while to shoot. So instead of the three people in a room, we're going to sort of open it out and have lots of people, lots of places. And I think from that original kind of outline, we started with the scene with Allison Madison and we ended with the scene with Allison Madison. And that stayed true in the very end. But as we started to work with the performers and write and adjust and develop all the scenes as we were going, it took on a life of its own, for sure. Like the material we really just started to say, oh, pick me. This has got energy, right? Who knew that Raymond character was so fascinating? Let's go more with him. Or so that sort of thing happened. And we were able to, because we're shooting over a period of time and the story takes place over a year, we were able to respond to that, which was really a lot of the fun. Because it was sort of documentary style storytelling with a drama. So it was a real mixture. Yeah.
Obviously the title is allusion to a different word for love every week of the year. And how easy was it for you guys to find those 52 words? Did you have a longer list and we'll whittle it down, or did you actually have to go and find a word from somewhere else that you thought would fit with the film?
So we had way more words than 52 to start with. And there was a stage where we had all of words all over the place. So we had them written on cue cards and it was all over the floor here. And and then in the film, but what happened was sort of over time, organically, certain words felt more resonant and more part of the story. And in the end, we also have quite a number of synonyms for words for love that are the words that Alice is thinking in her mind while she's trying to pick a word. And so we have that extra layer that aren't really words for love, but are synonyms for words for love that are just sort of spoken word. Mm. There are a lot more words for love than we included.
And the words ended up, at least, maybe this was your intention originally, Andrew, but anyway, they ended up becoming much more of a, for us, not only a thematic through line. Sure, it's also a device, a narrative device, to kind of keep track of the time over the course of the year, one word every week for a year. But they also became, we realized kind of, or crystallized for us, very close to the end of the process, like literally in sound post. Mm-hmm. Where we realized that the words were also Alice's interior monologue in essence, kind of commenting on either what had just come or what was about to come or what was happening in the moment. So they gave us not only the markers, physical kind of week-long markers in her process, and they mirrored her own internal process as she's going through treatment, etc., and in her search for meaning, but also like a larger thematic mm-hmm. kind of reflection, which was really exciting.
It was
fun. Like we literally recorded Stacey Eisman, who plays Alice, doing the, like actually speaking some of the words to give the sense of an idea of process. She's going through these words, trying to land on a word, almost like days before the final mix was finished, like that late into the process. We didn't know until that time. And we had an idea we were going to use them a little bit more, and then we pulled them back a little bit, but trying to find a home for them in the film. And it was a really interesting process that way.
You know, films about, I think, love and romance have always been around, but, you know, I guess the last 20 years, especially in romantic comedies, there's sort of been maybe a slight negative stereotype to those types of films. You know, I feel like it's something like How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days or, you know, anything like that, because people feel that there's nothing necessarily original in the storyline. And yet, maybe within the last 5 years, we're starting to see that change a little bit. And maybe that's just the times. Maybe that's people have different ideas about love. But why do you think, what have you seen in terms of how we approach or appreciate these types of thematic movies?
I think one of the things that I was really interested in doing with this film, and why I was interested in doing the film, was that my experience of love, that romantic comedy thing, is just not ever been my main relationship. It's never been the big important thing in my life. I'm not that there haven't been some, but my sister, my brother, my bestie, my filmmaking partner, you know, my exes from 30 years ago who are still in my life, like, the life is just richer than the most usual rom-com stories are. So looking at a diverse group of people going through their own experience of what they're of actual love, not a stereotype of, and the complexity of it. Like one character, his main relationship really is with his mom, right? Like, and that's, we don't see that. We don't.
And his son.
Oh, I was thinking.
Oh, sorry. Key. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
But there's that sort of Raymond too, with his mom and his son, and so. Sort of kind of taking a little bit of air out of that rom-com balloon and kind of trying to look more closely at what we're actually experiencing.
Yeah, and it's also the, you know, the sort of Hollywoodness of rom-coms in particular as a genre, you know, has been exploited so heavily, you know, over the last 20 years. As you say, you're under the weight of all of that anytime you take on a subject anything close to people's expectations, the language of film, you know, rom-coms, etc. And I think it was kind of interesting to see. We wanted to, I think, put out something into the world that was not that clean and where everything doesn't necessarily tie up neatly in a bow.
Right.
You know?
Where your most passionate relationship in your life is not the person you're going to marry, because that's a bad idea.
Where
your relationship ending is actually a good thing. Where it's all sorts of different kinds of relationships.
And the tricky thing is that nowadays, it's still kind of hard to sell that argument to an audience, because they're so used to being fed a certain diet, you know, of that kind of material. Mm-hmm. That it almost seems unreal to them that something, when it's presented in those terms, that could be something that's truthful.
Right. Because we learn from all the media that we watch, and then these ideas get entrenched. I actually, when we were working on this, I did a ton of research on love because it's such a fascinating subject. And I actually read an article, and I actually remember where it was from, where they said people who avidly watched rom-coms didn't have very good relationships. Tended to not have successful romantic relationships. And there was a correlation between the rom-com, and I don't think it's necessarily causal, but that sort of fantasy of what a relationship is versus the actual experience of living it, right?
I was going to say, you know, given that yesterday was Valentine's Day, I was seeing a lot of posts on social media about today, you know, single people or whoever, today I'm celebrating, you know, love of myself or the love that I share with my friends. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not necessarily romantic love, not necessarily sexual love, but that sort of intimacy you can still feel with another person. And do you feel like maybe in the last 5 or 10 years that our notion of what love is changing? Or is it, do you think the fact that technology and the web has just made us aware of so many different types of people that we're now, I guess, more open to it than we might have been in the past?
I think both are true. I think we've certainly come to a place where there's a lot more freedom for people, at least in Toronto, to be who they are and to have the kinds of relationships that they choose to have without a lot of discrimination. And I think that the technology means that people who might not have found other people who are similar can. So I think that's true. I also think there's a way that we're broadening into love that reminds me a lot of being a little kid. When Valentine's Day came around, we made a card for every kid in our class, and our grandmothers and our aunts made a card for everybody. And the big fun of Valentine's for me was delivering the cards to everybody, right? It wasn't about, I don't think I figured out till I was a teenager that the flowers my dad brought home at Valentine's Day were actually just for my mom. because we'd make heart-shaped cakes and we'd go and take candies around, and just for whatever reason, I thought it was for everybody. I didn't really get the romantic love part until quite a bit later. So maybe there's a sort of an organic place that we all have that's like our kid self, where we just want to kind of love everybody, and maybe that's gaining a little more acceptance again, instead of trying to be all grown up and just have you know, that stereotype that's very 50s still, right?
Yeah.
You know, we talked about Valentine's Day, you know, and rom-coms and the media, and how do you think, I guess, that commercialization of love and romance and sex even has affected the way we view relationships and we view how we interact with other people on a day-to-day basis?
Wow, that's a good question.
I mean, it's interesting. I'm trying to think of how it relates particularly to our film as well. I'm definitely, I think, you know, safe to say old-fashioned in the sense, if I think of my situation, relationships in my life. So there's a part of me that appreciates the rom-com, you know, history. It's not like I'm averse to that notionally. But I think when we were, like, for me, making 52 Words for Love was a lot about exploring the other types of love that people experience. And it, weirdly, releasing the film on Valentine's Day, you know, I mean, there's a certain marketing aspect to that because of the word love in the title. It's like, okay, when are you going to release your film? Well, Valentine's Day is a good day. But I must admit, yesterday, I felt weirdly, yesterday being Valentine's Day and the release of our film, I felt weirdly kind of like, I really liked Valentine's Day. Like some of the things that people were posting online and just the kind of, just there was like this very brief little explosion of focus on the notion of love. And apart from the commercialization of that, I actually kind of, you know, appreciated that. I have a harder time with Christmas for the same reasons, you know.
I think it's one of my favorite days of the year, and it's probably because I completely misunderstand what it's actually about. But the celebrating of love, I think, is really important. And I think that goes to your question of how the amount of pop culture we get these images of what it's supposed to look like. And I think that's really hard this like perfection, this like beautiful, you know, beach scenes and romance, and then the actual day to day can look less than, and it's actually not less than. And I think that's one of the reasons why I wanted to really examine it and do this film, was to look at those little moments that are so important if you're actually living them and you're present in your life, of somebody making you your morning coffee, or just, and that's not a big blown up thing. That's not, you know, you don't, well, maybe you would do it on your social media, you might post that coffee, but it's not what we post or what our social persona is. It's what we experience in our bodies and in our moment, you know?
Mm. It's tricky now too, because with the whole Insta culture, you know, and everybody curating their lives so that it's like a giant rom-com gone like completely ballistic, you know, on the internet.
Yeah.
But I was just thinking of it relative to our film, which has a social media component in it. You know, Alice starts this website called 52 Words for Love, you know, as an attempt to kind of reach out, I think, into the world a little bit, and in a way that I don't think she ends up really, or starts understanding what the potential that is. And when we were finishing the film, we had to create, like, collect imagery that would be representative of the characters, the different characters in the film. And none of our imagery is, you know, the perfect cup of coffee or, you know, those sort of very Instagram filtered images. They're much more people and relationships, you know, here's me with my kid and his 10th birthday or whatever, that sort of thing. And, but yet it still has like a power of those very, in those very simple images, when, curated in such a way, you know, and when given in an open way, and how they kind of come together for Alice, for the main character in the film, is that it's quite actually like emotionally powerful for her, that I think she realizes that, you know, her life was made up of much more than she even realized. And that the web and the, you know, the website allowed her to kind of see that physicalized, like, you know, like laid out in a way for her that she couldn't see otherwise.
Do you think social media has made things or made us more, like, we're all connected, but has everything gonna become more personal or less personal? Because there's the connection, but there's also that distance, that barrier.
Yeah.
I think both.
Yeah. There's you know, there's weird little moments. I'm not a big social media person, but there's been one or two things that have occurred via social media that wouldn't have happened otherwise in my life that were meaningful. So I was really happy about that. But I think there's also so much noise and so much attempt to, you know, so much pressure on people to curate their lifestyle and to present that everything's fine and everything's, you know, perfect. So that aspect of the of social media, I think, is...
And there's a weird permanence, you know, to it, even though there's...
Yeah.
It's kind of all newsfeedy and moving along, but pictures from way back are still floating around, and like, so we're sort of much more on display, like permanently on record, which maybe means there's less room for mistakes, or more hypervigilance around presenting oneself, and that means that maybe we don't...
It's harder to be honest.
It's harder to be honest.
Yeah.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
There's a great scene in the film where one of the ladies asks the question, if an alien came down and asked us to describe what love is, I don't know what I would say. Have you thought about the answer to that question?
I actually sat in and was interviewed one afternoon because one of our interviewees was too nervous to be interviewed by herself, and Steph did the interview for the first half, and we actually answered that question. It's my favorite question of the whole lot. It's the silliest, but the answers are really interesting. I think what I said was, "Try it, you'll love it." Like, it was like something like that. But I loved what one of the interviewees, Danny, said, which was maybe the aliens would have a lot to teach us about love. And I really liked that. That was a surprise, and I really liked that. I thought, yeah, maybe they would.
Mm. It's interesting. It brings up a question, too, that I think there's an expectation that when you make a film that's about a subject matter, like in our case, 52 Words for Love, that you're going to somehow prescriptively tell the audience what they need to know so that at the end of the day, they will walk away from the film and go, oh, I'm so glad I saw that film because now I know what love is. Or now I understand how love works in my life or whatever. And that was never our intention. Mm-hmm. As filmmakers or as storytellers, our intention was more rather to lay out a smorgasbord of ideas mm-hmm. around the nature of love and let people cherry pick, you know, whatever worked for them. So
with this sort of a through line of like, pay attention, like the little moments and stay present and what just happened and
yeah.
How was that? Like to just be curious about it.
Yeah. And not always necessarily expecting that, you know, love is going to be this eureka moment or this big lightning bolt is going to strike or, you know, you'll know when this moment happens. But that love is happening all the time in tiny little ways, like in your everyday interactions.
Yeah.
Literally.
Literally.
Know? Yeah. Which is pretty cool.
And then if we were present, then we won't get to the end of our lives and feel like we blinked and missed it, you know, that
yeah.
we'll have experienced mm. it.
But is it also one of those questions that doesn't really have an answer? Because, you know, you'll
it's ask right up there with death.
You'll ask 52 people, and you'll get 52 different answers of what because love is so personal.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And it's almost like my mom used to say, "Are you trying to F the ineffable?" Like there's some sort of a, yes, I'm effing right now. This sort of, but it's really rich to, you know.
Well, that's what makes it such a fascinating topic. I mean, you know, and also universal.
Yeah.
Well, the film is 52 Words for Love. It's out now. James, Andrea, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dan.
That was really fun.
And that was Andrea Moody and James Blockland. Their new film, 52 Words for Love, is out now. My next guests are Jerry Hirauka and Tyler Gledhill. They are both artists and dancers with the company Opera Atelier. They have a new show, The Angel Speaks, which is playing for one night, February 21st, at the Royal Ontario Museum. This piece was actually originally performed at the Royal Chapel in Versailles, and it features the Canadian premiere of Annunciation, a new commission by Toronto-based composer and violinist Edwin Huizinga, and it's based off of the poem by Rainer Maria Rilke. In addition, they'll have soprano Murray Esselin and baritone Jesse Bloomberg and members of the Tafel Music Baroque Orchestra under the direction of David Fallis. In addition to Edwin's original composition, The Angel Speaks also features celebrated Baroque music by Henry Purcell and William Boyce, who are both clear inferences for Huizinga's contemporary composition. I got to speak with Atelier ballet artist and contemporary choreographer Tyler Gledhill and dancer Jerry Hirauka about the project. Here's our conversation. Tyler Gledhill, Jerry Hirauka, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So, The Angel Speaks. I'm intrigued by this. It's sort of a mix of classical Baroque and contemporary dance. And I know, Tyler, you are the contemporary choreographer,
yes.
As well as a performer. When you're sort of combining two or more styles of art, styles of dance, what do you look for in terms of how you choreograph the piece?
Well, for me, it definitely started with the music. So this composition by Edwin Huizinga is—he is a classically trained violinist, he's played in the Baroque style for several years. So it's not like he went off and did something totally contemporary. There is some sort of link to the Baroque music, So for me, it started with the music. I had to listen to the music 1,000 times and just really feel like it was in me, and I knew exactly what was coming next, and for me, that's what informs movement. But I also, you know, I've been dancing in the Baroque style for just over 10 years now with Opera Atelier, so I know a lot about that as well. So I tried to make something that would, you know, blend in with the Baroque choreography well without looking too, you know, obscure or out there. Yeah, so there are a lot of shapes, a lot of, I'd say, like, arm movements and positions that I'd say are inspired by the Baroque style that I used.
And, Jerry, I mean, I know you're a classically trained ballet dancer, and we were sort of talking about before how this is almost tailor-made for ballet because it's very, you know, classical and sort of old school in style, but it's quite adaptable to a contemporary art form. What intrigued you about this project and the blending of different styles from a strictly dance and sort of very technically proficient style of dance?
For me, like, it's just a collective work with like Marsha Jeanette, also Tyler and Edwin, who is such an amazing talent. And for the parts I danced, it's only Baroque style, but like the Angel Speak part with like Tyler's leading us to like make this a beautiful piece, and that was, I think, the collaboration of it. I think that's the most interesting.
What I'm really intrigued about is the fact that Edwin's piece, Annunciation, is based on a poem by Rilke, the great German poet. How much of that background played into your constructing the choreography based on, because it's got this poetic element too, not just strictly music.
Yeah. So there is kind of a story. I mean, you don't necessarily have to know what it is or even have to pay attention to the exact words that are being sung by the two singers in the piece. But there is like a narrative to it, and that informed kind of like the through line of the piece and how we interact. And also, we've been like Marshall Pankowski, the director, and Jeanette Lajeunesse Singh, the choreographer who handled all the Baroque elements. They had a very clear vision of how they wanted it to go, and so it really was like a group effort. There was a lot of collaboration between everybody involved. Dancers, singers, and then the direction and composer too. So like it was really a full team effort. Yeah.
And of course you mentioned the narrative, and like so much of classical music, it's inspired by religion, religious texts, religious backstory. I know that the Annunciation is about when Mary discovers that she's pregnant with the Son of God. As choreographers, as performers, although they're singers in this, a lot of times that style, that form of art doesn't have words. So how do you go about portraying and constructing that narrative from a strictly visual way, I guess?
I think it's... touched on before, I don't think that you need to actually, I mean, so much of in contemporary dance, a lot of it is, well, there, sometimes a choreographer has a very clear story of what's going on and has informed the performers, or sometimes not informed the performers, but has used certain tools to get what they need out of the performers.
Right.
And sometimes it's shared in program notes, sometimes it's not, and that's what I love about contemporary dance is the audience can draw their own conclusions and make up their own story based on what they see. And like, those are all correct answers. And so, you know, having read the poem several times and knowing what the direction was about, but I'm not being a very religious person at all, so I don't really have that big of a connection to it. It was more important for me to just to connect with the other performers and to create this harmony.
Jerry, maybe you can speak to the performance aspect of it as someone who is dancing in the Baroque section of the work. How do you, when you're on stage, how conscious are you when you're trying to you're focusing technically on your moves, but you're also trying to construct this story as you do. What was your process like for that?
For me, it has been very easy since Masha's direction is very clear from the beginning of the rehearsal. So like he would explain like what his goals achieved, and again like all like collaboration, like Tyler's movements inspires us, so was Edwin's music, and we just keep feeding each other almost. That I almost don't have to think how I should like project to the performance, so like it can come out naturally.
Mm.
I think, especially like with this concert, it's very like smaller scale compared to like being a big stage. So like I think it has to be more personal too. So that being gentle and being genuine in that way, I think will tell a story better to the audience.
We've been talking a lot about Edwin's original composition, but there's also two other composers featured in this: Henry Purcell and William Boyce. And I know that. Classical music people are probably familiar with Purcell, but I would say a lot of people maybe don't know Boyce as well as Purcell. How familiar were you two with those composers and their music, and how quickly did you have to learn about them prior to making this piece?
To be honest, I already knew from like music history classes. So.
Right, and we had both danced in one Purcell opera a few years ago, but with Opera Atelier. But the William Boyce completely unfamiliar until we heard the music that we were going to dance to. So didn't really. I mean, yeah, it all came together so quickly that there wasn't really like didn't really need to do. Any research into that also is because the voice that we're using or that we dance to, it's, I think it's like such stunning music and it has Baroque elements. And then there are parts where I do some contemporary stuff. And for me, it was so easy to choreograph to because it's absolutely beautiful. And just hearing it was, it just felt like the music was in my body.
And if that was enough, you guys are joined on stage by the Tafel Music Baroque Orchestra, which are amazing, probably the best company to do what they do in Canada. And I know they play a lot of stuff on period instruments as well. What was it like, for both you as performers and choreographers, working with that type of group on this type of project?
I mean, we know Tafel Music so well because they have been accompanying the opera, or Opera Atelier, for as long as, well, longer than we've both been dancing with them. So we know a lot of the musicians and we get to, hang out with them in the studio and stuff when we have rehearsals and things. But this was a little bit more special because it was a more intimate setting. There's almost as many of them as there are of us. We're kind of, they're not in the pit below us. They're like on the same level as us. So we actually got to interact with them a lot during rehearsals and talk about, things like tempo and intention and stuff like that. So it was really great.
And oftentimes in operatized production, because they are part of orchestra, so we don't really get to listen to each instrument and each player's sound, but in this concert, we really get to hear them playing like individual notes, which is nice.
And you're also joined by two singers on stage, Morel and Jesse. When you're dancing, when you're choreographing, how much? What kind of conversations do you have with the non-dance members of the production?
They're both very seasoned artists, and they've also worked with Opera Atelier a number of times, and. To say the way that Marshall works as a director is he makes even the singers be very physical. So the way they move is it is choreography. Like it's not just staging. It's not just walk here, stand here, and sing. They're very physical. Like they work out the sweat. But these two particular artists, they're very game to try anything. There are moments where, is it okay if I lift you? And Mireille, she's so willing to just try anything. So there are moments where I lift her, and then there are parts where Jesse and I were almost like doing a tug of war sort of thing, like almost like, yeah, wrestling and really using each other's body weight. And it's awesome to work with people who aren't dancers and have them be so enthusiastic about that.
I know you guys just, you actually played this last year as well in Versailles, and now you're coming here. That's a whole other world, and just in terms, and it, you know, just in terms of the culture and all the architecture there. But just what was that like getting to go over there and premiere this piece? And I heard there was an eight minute standing ovation or something.
Something like that, yeah. It's quite special.
It's very such a, like, with history in the Royal Chapel, like, which I think we are the first group to do dance performance, something
yeah.
like that. So it's like, it's such a privilege, and the intimacy in the air and the feel of it, I don't think it's really hard to recreate anything in any other places. But it just there are certain points I got very emotional doing in both rehearsal and performance as well. Just get overwhelmed.
Yeah, it's what I mean. It's such an incredibly beautiful space to be in, and there's just so much history there, and so that you kind of feel all that. And also just like there's so much to look at. Like, so I found, I mean, the first time we performed there was it was spring 2017.
Yes.
Yeah. So, almost 2 years ago. And I remember it was like the choreography had changed once we stepped in there. I was looking up so much more than I was. And that just, I mean, it kind of had this, you know, like, cause there is this, it's supposed to be like we're angels, and so what? It just kind of felt like we were flying a little bit, like we're in the clouds.
Obviously, a chapel and a church is a very different venue than a gallery at a museum, which is where the performance next week is taking place. How do the acoustics of each specific venue affect the performance, would you say? Because a chapel, and the way it's designed, especially a chapel like the one in Versailles, is going to have very, very different acoustics than the museum would.
I would say, like, performing in the chapel, like, the music tends to be more softer than what it is. And, like, at the ROM, when we performed last year, it felt more, like, direct to, like, our ears. So that's the only difference I noticed. But, like, otherwise, the feel of it, I think, is still, yeah, pretty much the same as the performing chapel.
Yeah, definitely the volume, like, just because, I mean, the chapel, it's the ceiling is so high, it's interesting the way sound bounces. It's like it kind of just, not like fades out, but it's like, you know, it just, it's like it's coming from,
yes.
Yeah, like it
got
goes,
Michael,
it, yeah, yeah, it goes really far away quickly, you know,
yeah.
You just feel like, whoa, you know, and whereas in the ROM, yeah, it's just like the ceiling's lower, and it's more enclosed, and so you really feel the power and the vibration.
On that note, how much did you find that you had to adapt or maybe slightly alter any of the choreography from venue to venue, if at all?
I don't really feel like I had to adapt any of the choreography for the, like the surface, the floor is a little bit different. I mean, both spaces are not dance floor. Like in the chapel in Versailles, it's
marble,
you know,
floors.
Hundreds of years old marble, and it, like it's jagged in some places. I mean, the first time we performed there, Jerry and I were dancing a duet, and I slipped and almost fell and banged my knee. And the people that were in front of me, I could hear a collective kind of gasp. And then this past time, for the contemporary dance, I'm dancing in socks because it works best for me. And when I wore a brand new pair of socks that I'd worn for just the dress rehearsal, and then after the show, I looked like I took them off, holes, like I couldn't wear them again. Like, they're completely ripped to shreds because the floor is just so jagged. Whereas at the ROM, it's like a hardwood
floor, which is also slippery, too, I remember.
Yeah, very, very slippery. and so the last time we were there, I actually didn't wear any shoes or socks at all. I performed it barefoot because I needed the grip. So we'll see what happens this year.
Yeah.
What is it like as a dancer performing on an unfamiliar or perhaps different surface. You know, it's not a stage, it's not a hardwood floor. You said marble. I know museums have a lot of carpet. How does that affect maybe how you move technically?
Well, being on stage, because we have feet away from the audience, we have to really be dynamic in the movements, or use a facial expression or eye contacts. But in the setting Royal Chapel or here at the ROM, there we are surrounded by the audience 360, so we have to try to engage people in a way, so not to looking up too far, just really looking into them and almost dancing directly with them. That's how I approach.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's different than the way that we project because of where the audience is located. Yeah, but I've danced on all kinds of crazy, weird surfaces, and you just have to keep your wits about you because anything can happen. It's unpredictable, and but that's what also makes it exciting.
Does being in a more enclosed, intimate space, how do you find that changes the dynamic of a show? Is it more of a challenge because you're that much more closer and that much more connected to the audience than you might be in a big auditorium or a chapel where it's much larger?
I don't know. I mean, it's so funny because talking to other performers, some people really love just to be on stage where the audience is black, mm-hmm. You can't see any faces, and sometimes when, depending on the theater, the audience can be closer, if there isn't an orchestra pit or whatnot, and you can actually see people's eyes, and some people come off stage and say, oh my gosh, I could see my mom in the audience, and that freaked me out. I don't want to see anybody. And whereas I love these sort of venues where, you can make eye contact with the audience and connect with them and stuff, and I think that just makes for a more powerful performance, and you just reach them in a different way, and I think, and also as an audience member, I love being in venues like that where I'm so close to the dancers because I just think I get more out of it.
It's true. I was only used to performing in big theater for about 10 years, so last time we did the chapel concert, the very first time in such intimate setting, and I almost got nervous, but the emotion that took me over, so that was fine. But now I do really enjoy it in the small setting, to make it more personable for me and for the audience as well.
You mentioned that you've worked with both the Tafa Music Orchestra and Mireille and Jesse in the past quite a bit. Does that make it easier when putting together a piece to have frequent collaborators and friends on board? Does that make the rehearsal process, the construction of the piece easier because you have a good working relationship, or is it a challenge because you know these guys so well and there is that element of comfort and you don't want to fall back into that?
No, I think it's definitely because we have that history, we're used to performing together, we're really comfortable. There's just this, Yeah, it's really harmonious and everybody's completely on board and ready to go and yeah, I definitely think it's a plus.
Yep, I agree with him. It's really nice to have that almost a family working together. It's a good team.
Yeah.
So this show, at least right now, is a one-night only performance next Thursday. How, knowing that it's only one night and there's one show, how much does that increase the pressure you feel? Because, if you're doing a theater show or a run of shows, it's if you're not perfect or you miss one thing, there's the next night or the other show that day. But this one is a one and done, so to speak, type of thing. How does that maybe mentally affect you at all?
Well, I approach to each performance as the last one, so I don't think as there's nothing to recreate, so it doesn't put any pressure. It's the same as other performances, but it will have a different.
I mean, I think that makes it all the more special. And I mean, that's what makes the performing arts special as a whole, you know, like often for an audience, they'll go see something once. Maybe they'll go see it again if they really, really loved it. Like, you know, a lot of people do that in musical theater. But what makes this art form so spectacular is it's fleeting. Like, it doesn't last. You can't take, well, you can take a photo of it, but it doesn't actually capture the feeling of it. A video, everything looks flat. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, you know, and that's what's so special. It's in this moment. It's like, you know, and it's over, but you, like, it makes you feel something. And so, yeah, and it's such a small percentage of what our job actually is. Like, we spend hours and hours and hours in the studio creating and sweating and arguing and getting frustrated, and but also having, like, really beautiful moments and stuff, and it's, that's all great. But like, you know, the main event is a show. And so, like, for a one-hour performance, sometimes you'll put in, like, 60 hours of rehearsal, which is nuts, and that's just such a small percentage. But that's supposed to be, like, the thing, you know, and that's what makes it so special, is that, like, it's this tiny little moment that you have to savor.
With this show, you'll bring in fans of classical music, classical dance, and you'll also bring in the fans of contemporary dance, and maybe even fans of poetry. What do you hope people who are not familiar, like, the what do you want the classical music fans to get out of the maybe the contemporary portion, and vice versa? What do you want the audience as a whole to get out of the show when they come and watch it?
Well, I hope they get to see something that they haven't seen before, and that might be, you know, the blending of the styles, or maybe they haven't even seen contemporary dance before. I just hope that they're open to it, and that it somehow makes them feel something positive, and they can take something away from it.
Yes. I was thinking same thing too. Like, I hope this could be a good introduction for the, like, non-classical people to the Baroque music and dance, or the non-contemporary people to, like, make them interested in going to see contemporary dances.
What are you most excited for? What are you most looking forward to about the show?
I am very looking forward to really experience that amazing, like, emotion wave I had at the chapel. Like, it's just so incredible. It's especially in the Edwin's that's playing the melody, and that got me, so I hope to have that emotion again.
Yeah, I mean, it's the whole show really is a journey, and it's just exciting to be able to go on that again, like, because every time that we've, I mean, now it's been kind of changed. This is version 2.0, you could say, but, like, we did the first version, it was just a one-off in Versailles, and then almost a year later we were at the Rhône, and then, like, 6 months later version 2.0 was at Versailles, and then now we're at the Rhône again. And so it's like every time it happens, it's just like this one time that we get to taste it, and but it's like, it's such a, in that 1 hour, we, like, so much happens. So yeah, that's what I'm looking forward to, is just going on the journey again.
Well, the show is The Angel Speaks by Opera Atelier, and it is at the Royal Ontario Museum in the Samuel Hall Curley Gallery, February 21st at 8 p.m. Tyler, Jerry, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And that was Tyler Gledhill and Jerry Hrauka of Opera Atelier. Their new show, The Angel Speaks, plays February 21st at the Royal Ontario Museum. That about does it for me this week. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now.